Hi, I'm Elena.
And I'm Brennan.
We are Canadians for Kyoto,
and you're listening to
The Green Majority
on CIUT 89.5 FM.
We're now joined by Andreas Marujos, director of the University of Toronto Blue Sky Solar Racing Team. Good morning.
Good morning, Jordan.
Now, your team has just released a new vehicle. This has been a long time in the works. Tell us, first of all, what it is that you've released.
We've released our fifth-generation solar-powered car. It was unveiled on August 9th at Hart House. This new vehicle seats a driver and a passenger. It generates roughly 2,300 watts of power, cruising speed of 90 kilometers per hour, and will be participating in the World Solar Challenge in October in Australia. This car took roughly 4 years of design and development to come to fruition. We started working on it in 2003. Roughly two of those years were spent in design, and the other two were spent in construction, development, and testing of the vehicle.
So now that you've released the vehicle, you have been you've been demonstrating. I imagine there's been a couple introductions. Has this been met with some degree of fanfare here at the University of Toronto?
It has. It's been highly anticipated within the university community and as well in the Toronto community. We've done a whole series of public events since the unveiling. We are currently showing our 2001 vehicle at the Canadian National Exhibition in the Music Building, and we will be taking the new vehicle there on occasion to participate in the daily parade.
So you're expecting some degree of media attention from this, and you've had some already. To what extent is this part of the mission of this project? You're hoping to achieve some degree of awareness, I imagine.
Yes, one of the primary focuses of our particular project is to try and raise awareness not only of environmental issues, but of environmental technologies surrounding those issues and how technology today can help improve the environment and certainly help prevent some of the types of pollution that we're seeing today.
So, is this goal something that you've been able to measure? Have been meeting with the success you've been hoping to on having released this vehicle?
Yes, we've been the way we measure our public events, I guess, is we try and do as many community and university events as possible. We've been ramping up our publicity over the last year or so. Last year alone, we did over 30 community events in the GTA area and in the surrounding area as well. We've been as far as New York City on one occasion last fall, and we'll be returning to New York City actually in September. And looking forward with the new vehicle, since August, we've done several events, and the World Solar Challenge is just the beginning of the tour, I guess, that this vehicle will have over the next few years as we take it around southwestern Ontario, showing it to people and talking to people about green technology.
Now, this first challenge for the vehicle, the World Solar Challenge, talk about that.
The World Solar Challenge is a cross-country race in Australia, roughly 3,000 kilometers across the Australian outback desert. It's been going on for about 20 years now. In fact, I think this year is their 20th anniversary of that event. It happens every 2 years in Australia, so that event's been going on now for about 30 to 40 years.
Wow. So 30 to 40 years of solar car races, that's quite a legacy. What does it say about the distance that solar cars have come in that period? Your car presumably represents some pretty substantial gains since those first vehicles rolled out.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the technology began to emerge in the 1970s and was played around with by some of the major car companies. And this event was started as one way of promoting the technology to help it grow. Over the years, more universities have been involved, more educational institutions, high schools, technical schools, and the technology has really been able to progress a long way. Typically, in the World Solar Challenge, there'll be roughly 20 teams participating. This year, we're finding that there's 42 teams that will be participating in the World Solar Challenge, which is a record for them, and certainly with this year's and last few years' attention to environmental issues, this is going to be a highly publicized event.
So people are going to hear about this one, and what should they be watching for with respect to the U of T solar car team? Are you expecting to make any particular achievements with this new vehicle?
Well, in general, participating in the race is meant mostly as a friendly drive to promote alternative energies. However, we do have a bit of a competitive spirit in us this year. The new vehicle has very highly advanced batteries and solar cells, and we're really hoping to perform very well in the desert. Specifically, we're looking to break the speed record that's been held. Well, there's two speed records. The first one was set by Honda in 2001, which was a two-seater solar car, and they have the two-seater solar car record for the speed across the Australian outback at 95 kilometers per hour. So we're aiming for that. Above that is the general speed record set by the Nuna team of the University of Delft in the Netherlands. Their speed is 104 kilometers per hour across the outback. They set that in 2005. So we're hoping at the very least to meet Honda's record, but if we can make it all the way to 105 kilometers per hour, that would be great.
104 kilometers an hour. Those are highway speeds. This is all just sunshine, is that right?
Absolutely.
So talk about the relationship between these types of challenges that have been posed and the development of this technology. Is the competition driving manufacturers to produce better solar cells? Are you simply representing the cutting edge of this technology? Or what can be said for producing new generations of solar vehicles?
Well, certainly the existence of the World Solar Challenge and other international events with regards to solar racing has really helped push solar cell development. With all major solar cell companies, especially the ones that produce space-grade solar cells, the solar car projects are sort of a keystone project for them because it's a way that people can see their technology in action. It's very hard to see a satellite in action, especially from Earth. And it's a very good promotion for them to show how far the technology has come and how much that can be done if properly implemented on a vehicle. And so certainly our involvement, not only with the solar cell companies, with the battery companies as well, with the aerospace companies and the development of these technologies and the synthesis of the technologies into a vehicle has really helped spur the development.
So it's more of a, you're demonstrating the technology. You're not demonstrating it in so far as it would contribute to an actual solar vehicle in a large scale production. This is more about demonstrating the potency of the technology, or what is the direct aim of such implementation?
Well, certainly the car is designed with two things in mind. First of all, we use the latest in cutting-edge technology, the latest in solar cells, the latest in batteries, and of course the latest of anything is very expensive. So it's certainly not geared to a price-sensitive consumer market. The other thing that we try and do is we try and push the efficiency of the vehicle as much as possible. What this means is that we try and take every watt of power we can from the sun and turn it into useful forward momentum for the vehicle. So, of course, the main way we do this is through aerodynamics. Of course, play a central role in energy consumption of the vehicle. We try and keep those down. We try and keep the heat dissipation down. All the electronics are tuned very carefully to produce very high efficiencies. And the net efficiency of the vehicle in end, in energy consumption, is in the high 90s, which is much different than you would expect in a regular consumer vehicle.
90 watts?
90%, sorry.
90, okay. 90% of the energy being used by that vehicle is going into momentum forwards.
Absolutely.
So you, I think, once told me that the total power consumed by this vehicle was comparable to that of some kitchen appliances, like a toaster. Is that actually that little power required to push a vehicle forward at those speeds?
Oh, absolutely. We've been slowly increasing our power. We're currently at around 2,300 watts, which is maybe two small toaster ovens or a large microwave or two large microwaves, certainly less than a fridge would use. And with that power, we can propel two people at roughly 100 kilometers per hour across the desert.
That's remarkable. So using these solar cells, other applications might include large-scale energy farms. There's been a plant proposed, if not agreed upon, in Ontario. We're expecting a solar farm in Ontario. Does this mean that this technology is ready, or is it something that is in the works, or what degree can we count on this to other applications at a large institutional scale?
Solar cell technology as a way of generating power in general for household and commercial applications is very much viable today. In fact, it is so viable that demand for these solar cells has gone through the roof and has been able to steady the price slightly. However, the price point right now for these types of power generating stations is very good, and it will only get better over the next 5 years. And the technology is definitely ready today for general use.
But these are quite expensive. That is the drawback of this particular technology.
Well, the specific cells that we use in our project tend to be the higher grade ones. However, there are lower grade terrestrial cells that can still produce several kilowatts of power within a reasonable area and within a reasonable cost. And you're seeing the emergence of more and more of these solar farms and more of these solar installations. The big problem right now is that the industry has been very slow to react. Solar cell production always relied on SLU from the semiconductor industry and never had an industry of its own to support the steady manufacture of solar cells. Now that this is coming to fruition, some companies have begun investing in solar foundries to specifically produce solar cell technology. Unfortunately, these foundries take roughly 5 or 6 years to come online, and we're going to see that big production come online roughly around 2010, where you're really going to see the price points drop heavily, and you're going to see higher efficiencies across the board.
So we might see prices drop by 30%, or what kind of change are we talking?
Absolutely. The prices will likely drop in excess of 30%. Of course, as the prices drop, demand will go up, and that will probably mitigate the price drop to an extent. But of course, cells will become much more readily available in the next few years.
Now, one of the concerns or criticisms that people have levied against solar production is the amount of space that it takes up. And they say if you want to put a power plant together that would put out the same output as a coal-fired plant or a nuclear-powered plant, that you'd have to take acres and acres and acres of space simply covered with solar cells. What's your response to that?
Well, what I would suggest to the individual making these comments is that they've really kind of fixed the way they think about power distribution. And the way power distribution is done today is that we have large central power generating units which generate a lot of power and distribute it to all the people who actually consume, to all the consumers. There's other power distribution models that suggest that perhaps it'd be possible to scatter your sources of energy instead of having one large power plant producing lots of energy, have lots of small power producers producing smaller amounts of energy and distributing it locally. So what this would mean, say, in a Toronto community or in a small community is that everyone could have a small solar array on their house or on their roof, which really doesn't take up any more space, but can produce power, say, for that house or for the neighboring houses as well. And that power is then distributed through the grid to wherever the load is needed.
So you'd have a solar panel on your house. I understand that in Toronto in particular, this high-voltage transmission method from a central power generator is actually becoming a bit of a problem, that this has become a political issue recently. They have to put in new electrical corridors into the city if they want to maintain that approach. So perhaps this could be used as an alternative to that.
Oh, absolutely. A distributed power generation network is far more stable, electrically speaking, and is far less prone to system outages. Of course, as you know, the major blackout, I think it was in 2003, which turned power off, was simply a result of having too many large producers, and when one goes down, the others can't balance the load properly, and then they all shut down one at a time as part of a safety. And when you have a distributed network of power producers, smaller power producers, if one goes out and one comes on, it has a lesser impact on the power distribution network.
Now, if we could just, we only have a couple minutes, but if we could speak about the solar car again, and specifically what it is about this particular vehicle that has been a change from the most recent generation. What is new and improved about this that we can be excited to hear about in the World Solar Challenge?
Well, the primary thing that we've managed to change this year compared to other years is we've actually managed to accommodate a passenger in the vehicle as well as a driver. In the past, we've only accommodated a driver purely because we didn't have enough power to move the extra mass. But now, with the new solar cells we've been able to receive and the new electrical system we've been able to rig up, we've been able to have enough power to transmit not and trans transport not only a passenger, but a driver as well, or a driver and a passenger. In addition, the solar cells we've been able to acquire this year are a little bit different than the ones we've used in the past. Typically, we use terrestrial-grade cells, which means they're silicon cells, and they have fairly low efficiencies. This year, we've been able to equip the solar car with gallium arsenide solar cells. These are space-grade solar cells. These are the same solar cells used on the Mars rovers and Hubble Space Telescope, and these have greatly increased our power output roughly by 50%. On the new vehicle.
So this is straight from NASA. These are the same solar panels.
Yes.
Very interesting. Andreas, we're going to have to leave it there, but stick around. We can continue our discussion after the break.